Hey, good morning, everybody. Good morning. This is Bio 241, and it is March 12. And we're in the nervous system chapter. That's a really long chapter. I'll turn the lights off in a second because I want to draw something on the board after I talk a little bit. But let's get the schedule out of the way first. So today is the 12th indeed. So we're at the end of the seventh week and we're in chapter 7. This is the middle lecture that we're going to have on nervous system. We got to cover a little bit more, one more chapter before the test, and that's autonomic nervous system. So you might want to go back and review over the weekend something about autonomic nervous system, the anatomy of it, because you might not have time next week. So do it over the weekend so you're prepared for that lecture on Thursday. All right, and then in a week and a half from today, the 24th of March, is exam number 2. And that's scheduled for 4, 5, 7, and 9. 4, 5, 7, and 9 are the chapters. All right, and then after that's Tuesday. Then Thursday we're going to have a lecture. We're going to finish up sensory physiology, and then it's spring break. Yeah, for teachers. But you guys might be able to get a little break too. Maybe. I'm not so sure. Okay, anybody have a question on the schedule? A lot of things planned, a lot of study groups, I'm sure. A lot of online assignments to do, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so you guys are good? No questions on the schedule? Okay. Well, let me see if you can remember this illustration that we looked at. I think it was in the very first chapter. Okay, you guys got to head outside if you don't want to just listen, okay? Because I don't want you to disturb other people that are around you. Please. Okay? Step outside if you have to talk. Do you remember this illustration? It was a graph of blood glucose concentration versus time. So we'll put time right here. All right. And in a normal person, what can you tell me about blood glucose concentration? It's pretty much, sort of constant, but not really. What does it do? It dances around within a normal range, right? And it dances around what we call that set point. Right, and if it's dancing around a set point and never goes above that normal or below that normal range, what do we see is being maintained?
Homeostasis,
that's right. And remember that we said that a response loop is used to maintain homeostasis in the body. And you know of how many kinds of feedback are there?
Two,
positive and negative. Which one maintains homeostasis? A negative feedback loop. Okay, so here we have a volunteer, like one of you guys in lab. Okay, and you agree to be injected with a bolus of insulin. We'll just shoot you up with a big bolus of insulin. What's going to happen to blood glucose levels? Yeah, it's just going to drop because insulin is the passport that allows glucose to enter cells and it leaves the blood. So glucose drops like that. All right, and since you're normal, what's going to happen to blood glucose after this initial drop due to this challenge of insulin? Okay, I heard drop. I don't think it's going to drop anymore. What I like to see is what? It's going to go back up to that normal range once again, right? So if you see an abrupt change, and that change then is resisted or inhibited or reversed so that something goes back to the normal range, what kind of feedback loop is happening here just by a casual inspection? Nice negative feedback loop, right? Because this parameter goes back toward the set point. Okay, and yeah, glucagon is involved with that. We're going to look at that when we get into the endocrinology chapter. But anyway, just kind of remember, right, this general silhouette of what negative feedback looks like. Right, you can see that very quickly. All right, so now I turn the lights off, and we're just going to look at projector number 1, and then I'm going to go into slideshow mode because nobody has a question regarding the schedule slideshow, and let me make sure I get my cursor back. Yeah, pointer options, arrow options. Too bad I can't do this ahead of time, but not if I want to show you that schedule. All right, so look at what we have right here. We've got a plot of something, membrane potential versus time. Right, so instead of blood glucose versus time, this is voltage versus time across the membrane. And then all of a sudden we see a precipitous change, right, in that membrane potential. And we discussed last time that that was a nice positive feedback mechanism that was happening. What kind of channels were being activated here? sodium channels, that's really good, but I want a little bit more detail. What kind of sodium channel? How is it being activated? It's a gated channel, so it's normally closed, but it opens up because of a voltage, a change in voltage. So we call that a voltage-gated channel. A change in voltage across the membrane opens it up, all right? And so that kind of looks to me like this big precipitous drop in blood glucose when you give it an insulin, when you give somebody insulin challenge, all right? But then go back to the action potential. What happens? Does it keep going? Positive, positive, positive. What does the membrane voltage eventually do? It goes back to resting membrane potential, a little fluctuation, right? There's a little bit of overshoot here, but it does return to that set point. So what kind of feedback mechanism is happening over here under number two? A nice negative feedback mechanism, right? So can you all see that in the diagram? Very similar to this blood glucose diagram. So positive feedback in the very beginning, right? And the reason why the whole universe or all the cells in the universe aren't filled with sodium is because of what happens right here at plus 30 millivolts. The inactivation gate slams closed, right? That stops that positive feedback mechanism. Positive feedback can't go on forever. And even, yeah, and then even there is a nice negative feedback mechanism that brings the membrane potential back down to resting membrane potential. Somebody had some comments. Comments on that. Yeah.
Wait, after when you repolarize, like, does it become hyperpolarized when you go under the stimulus? Under the resting membrane?
Yep, under RMP we call that hyperpolarization. Okay. And as far as depolarization is concerned, what kind of event is that? Depolarization. Is that excitatory or inhibitory? It's excitatory. Yeah. What about repolarization here?
Inhibitory.
What about this hyperpolarization? Excitatory or inhibitory? Okay, it's going, excitatory is depolarization, okay, and when you hyperpolarize, you're going the opposite way, so that is inhibitory. So this area right here of hyperpolarization is indeed inhibitory, right? If it moves up toward threshold or if it depolarizes, that is excitatory. All right, so that's some, here is the sign-in sheet that I forgot to pass out, but fortunately I have it right here. Yeah, so just always kind of remember, depolarization is excitatory, hyperpolarization is inhibitory, and the other thing that you should know with this action potential is, what is a nice way to think of an excitatory event? What can happen to a cell that will excite this cell? I see it right here. Sodium rushing in, right? Any kind of positive charge rushing inside the cell, sodium is a good example. Anytime positive charge rushes inside the cell, that is excitatory. Anytime positive charge leaves the cell, that is inhibitory, right? Because that's hyperpolarization. Okay, so I just wanted to make sure that you saw that nice negative feedback mechanism restoring the membrane potential. We talked about that already. Okay, so here is another slide that compares the membrane voltage. We've got two graphs, membrane voltage versus time versus a change in permeability of sodium and potassium versus time. And these are justified together, right? So here's 4 seconds on both graphs. Here's 3, here's 2, here's 1 second on both graphs. So they line up really nice and perfectly. This thing right here you're familiar with. It's kind of a sloppy action potential because it doesn't show the stimulus, right? But that, nonetheless, it's still an action potential. And what we're going to see is those two voltage-gated channels that are responsible for this action potential. There's one that causes depolarization, and these channels, these voltage-gated channels, open rapidly, right? So that means that there's a rapid change in permeability to what ion? The sodium. So here is this line right here, it represents the change in permeability, right, or diffusion for sodium in particular. So these voltage-gated channels open rapidly, and of course they close rapidly once the inactivation gate is activated. That sounds weird. Activating an inactivation gate. But you know what I mean. It sounds terrible, but that's how I have to say it in English, right? Okay. So this very sharp sloped curve right here represents sodium, and then this other curve that has a longer duration and This represents potassium. So notice, both gates start to open up at the same time, but it's just that the sodium is faster. That's why it predominates in this depolarization phase. And that's why there's repolarization later, because the potassium gates are slower to open. That also means that they're slower to close after their inactivation gate, all right, becomes activated. All right, so what this slide really shows you is that this membrane potential is most directly related to what? Changes in permeability of these various ions. Right? So that's something we didn't look at when we did the Nernst equation. We just looked at static concentration of ions across the membrane. And I mentioned this, but I didn't really show you a graph. Now here is a nice graph that directly shows you that changes in permeability of ions does what to a membrane potential? It changes it, right? You see a change in membrane potential. So membrane potential is very sensitive to changes in membrane permeability, like opening or closing these gates. I think that's the take-home message right here. Okay. All right, so here I see some action potentials on this particular slide. And I also see that this is sort of an experiment because we are going to stimulate this particular cell. We're going to give it a stimulus. And what is that stimulus? What is it going to do? A stimulus does, what does it do to the cell? It does what? Oh, I hope you guys know because I'm blanking on this one right here. Yeah, it excites it. How does it excite that cell? By what kind of electrical event has to happen? Yeah, okay, that's a nice physical thing that's happening. And when sodium goes in, what's the electrical event that's happening? Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking of, right? Depolarization. All right, so here I see some stimuli that are going to depolarize the cell. And here is a very weak stimulus. It doesn't show that it is depolarizing the cell at all, but it's depolarizing the cell because this is just another kind of sloppy diagram. But what can you tell me about the stimulus? Right, because it does not result in an action potential. It causes depolarization, not shown on this particular illustration, but it doesn't trigger an action potential. So what can you tell me about that kind of stimulus? It is? Did it ever reach threshold? No. So we would call this a sub-threshold stimulus. It causes depolarization, but not to a sufficient level that it reaches threshold. And if it reached threshold, then an action potential would take place, right? And then that positive feedback mechanism would ensue, and the whole action potential would take place. All right, well, so we're not really satisfied with that sub-threshold stimulus. Let's increase the stimulus a little bit. All right, and how would we increase the stimulus? How would we do that? What do we have to do to that cell? We got to excite it by doing what to some electrical charge? Jamming some kind of positive charge inside the cell. Sodium would be a really good example. All right, so now we're going to increase, we're going to put more positive charges inside the cell somehow. And what can you tell me about this stimulus compared to the first one? It's a little bit bigger, but it is also? It's stronger. It's a bigger depolarization, larger depolarization. And this is at least a threshold stimulus. How do you know this is at least a threshold stimulus? Because it produced an action potential, right? So it at least reached threshold, right? And so it has to be bigger than this first one. All right. So we let the cell rest, come back to normal, and then we give it another stimulus, and we turn up the dial. We're going to give it even a stronger stimulus. And since it was stronger than the threshold stimulus, this is a threshold stimulus plus a little bit more, what's going to happen when that membrane potential reaches threshold? It's going to produce an action potential, right? So what did we have to do to that cell? We had to jam some positive charges in there somehow, right? Sodium ion would be a good example. Or maybe an electrical current, put some positive electrical current into the cell. Either way you want to think about it, it's fine. All right, and let the action potential then dies away. And then at another time, we come with another stimulus. So here is the fourth stimulus. And how do you see this fourth stimulus compared to these first three? Yeah, it's the strongest, right? So the length of this arrow represents the magnitude of that stimulus. And again, we know that this is going to be threshold because even the smaller one over here was threshold. So here's a threshold stimulus. And so what did that result in? An action potential, right? All right, so what this graph here shows nicely is that this action potential that we see right here, these three action potentials were triggered by these three threshold stimuli, but the stimulus intensity changed. Can you see we have a weak one, a little bit stronger one, and the strongest one right here? The magnitude or the amplitude of the stimulus changed, but what about the amplitude of an action potential?
Stayed the same.
Huh. That's sort of interesting. Okay. What about the duration of these action potentials? Does that change with the stimulus intensity?
No.
Measure the distance in time. What does it look like? Just kind of by inspection. Looks the same. All right. What about the color of this action potential? It's the same. What else? Too bad. I don't know what else. If you were to touch it, it would feel the same. So what can you tell me about all these action potentials? They are all the same. Right, so the action potential is going to be the same. It's not going to change when the stimulus changes. That is really strange. I think that's really, really strange. All right, so first take-home message there is never be tricked into thinking that action potentials change. They are always going to be the same. No matter how the question is worded, you're going to say action potential doesn't change. All right, the other thing is, what I find really strange, is that when I maybe talk about some of these other points on the slide over here. Okay, maybe I'm going to say something about this point. APs are produced by voltage-gated channels, right? Voltage-gated channels. All right, now your ears are being stimulated, right? Because I'm talking to you, right? Is that stimulation the same as when I read this to you? APs cannot summate because of blank, and we got to fill that in. Could you tell that there was a difference in stimulus reaching your ears? Well, how on earth is it, if all action potentials are the same, how is it that you can appreciate different levels of intensity if all action potentials are the same? Now, that sounds like a lot of gobbledygook. Okay, how is that possible? Okay, furthermore, action potentials are the language of the brain. That's how different parts of the brain or nerves talk to each other. All right, so when stimulus reaches your ears, it's converted into action potentials, and that action potentials will go to your auditory center. Did anybody know where your primary auditory cortex is? Can you remember from anatomy? Temporal lobe, yeah, temporal lobe. Kind of funny because that's kind of where your ears are right there, but temporal lobe, right? And so what's that information that gets to your temporal lobe from your ears? It is action potentials. And if you were to listen to an action potential, it would just be a blip. Right, so your temporal lobe is getting blips from your ear. Blip, 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 blip. Right? Because action potentials are really short in time. Well, how is it that the auditory cortex will know if it's high intensity stimulus or low intensity stimulus? And because you all told me you could actually hear the difference in intensity of my voice, I changed it, and that is the action potential amplitude is exactly the same, but the frequency at which they reach the auditory cortex changes. So the frequency increases as the stimulus intensity increases. So if I'm talking softly, what the auditory cortex is receiving is a blip, blip, blip. But if I'm talking loudly, right, I'm yelling at you, what is your auditory cortex hear? It hears a blip, 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 blip. Something very fast. Action potentials with the exact same duration, same amplitude, but there are more of them in a particular period of time. Okay, and that's what we call frequency coding. So here we could do an experiment with three stimuli once again. Here is a stimulus that we turn on and then we turn off. This is the amplitude, right? The amplitude is the stimulus strength is on the vertical axis. And so we turn it on and turn it off. And what can you tell me about this first stimulus? Does it produce action potentials? Yeah, it doesn't hit. So it's a sub-threshold stimulus, doesn't produce action potentials. What about the second stimulus?
It hits
threshold. Yeah, it reaches threshold. Okay, it's a little bit stronger, so this is at least a threshold stimulus. And we can see that in the same period of time, it produces four action potentials. And what can you tell me about these four action potentials? What, the color? The same. Amplitude? Same. Duration, if you got the microscope, you would see that they are exactly the same. All right, well, let's do the third stimulus. We're going to increase the intensity, but we're going to keep it on for the same period of time. So we turn it on, it's a stronger stimulus, and we're going to turn it off. It produces action potentials. And what can you tell me about this first action potential compared to the first one over here? It's the same. What about this first one compared to the last one over here? Yeah, what about this action potential compared to the one in the middle over here? Same, and the one on the end? The same. But what? So what's the difference? There's just more of them as the signal intensity increases. We call that frequency coding, right? So the frequency of action potentials reaching some part of the brain increases as the stimulus intensity increases. So action potentials can be the same. And as a matter of fact, it's great that they are the same. Okay. All right, so you would invoke frequency coding to explain why the brain can appreciate differences in stimulus intensity even though an action potential, which is the language, doesn't change, right? It's always going to be the same. We've got to go back to the previous slide and finish up some thoughts on action potentials. Okay, we talked about this first point right here, right when it reaches threshold. Here is something that's important. Action potentials propagate without decrement. Right? This means that when you have an action potential on one end of an axon and it moves along the axon down to the axon terminus, by the time that action potential reaches the axon terminus, what can you tell me? What is it like compared to what it was like at the beginning of the axon? Yeah, action potentials are always the same. So it doesn't decrease in amplitude. That's what we mean. Action potentials propagate from one part of a neuron to another without decrement, and as a matter of fact, action potentials move along the surface of a muscle cell as well, right? And it moves without decrement there just as well. All right, so what kind of what is necessary? What kind of membrane protein is necessary for an action potential? Okay, that's good. It's good we're thinking about this. What kind of membrane protein does this membrane have to have in order for an action potential to exist on that part of the membrane? What does it have to have? Ah, it says right here, it's got to have voltage-gated sodium channels to depolarize, right? And it's got to have voltage-gated potassium channels so that it can repolarize, right? So to answer this question right here, right, what kind of membrane proteins does an axon have to have in order to even start an action potential, much less propagate one? It has to have voltage-gated channels, right? Because we're going to learn of another kind of channel, another kind of gated channel in just a little bit. But voltage-gated, so action potentials are produced by what kind of membrane proteins? Voltage-gated channels, right? And now you know some for sodium and for potassium, okay? And voltage-gated channels. Voltage-gated channels are found only on the plasma membrane of axons. Voltage-gated channels are not found on the cell body of a neuron or dendrites. So here's a pretty good question for you. Can a nerve cell body or a dendrite propagate an action potential? And why is that? Because it does not have voltage-gated channels, right? Okay, so that cell is pretty smart. It puts these voltage-gated channels only in certain locations within the cell, and that is along an axon. And action potentials cannot summate, right? And I sort of talked about this, but not exactly, right? And that is for the following reason. Let's go back and look at a nice action potential once again. All right, so here we see that rapid depolarization, and it stops right here. Why does depolarization stop right here? Because what happens? Because that door slams closed. Because the inactivation gate gets triggered, right? And when that inactivation gate is triggered, no more sodium can leave or can enter the cell no matter what through those channels. So this is what we call a refractory period. Sodium cannot enter the cell because the inactivation gate is closed. And when sodium can't enter, what's prevented from happening? What kind of event is it when sodium, so depolarization, right? We're preventing depolarization, and depolarization is what kind of event? Excitatory event. So as soon as this inactivation gate is deployed, no further excitation can take place because depolarization is always going to be stopped. Right, that inactivation gate for sodium is released when membrane potential reaches resting level right here. But what happens to an action potential after it reaches the resting membrane potential? Does it just get stuck at RMP? It undershoots, right? And this undershoot area right here, we call that hyperpolarization. That is an inhibitory event. All right, so from the peak of an action potential to when it reaches resting membrane potential, there's absolute, it's in a, the, that neuron is an absolute refractory period, can never be stimulated into a, another excitatory event because all those sodium channels are just closed, right? And then over here, this is what we call a relative refractory period because the sodium channels can be reopened, right, with a threshold stimulus. But what does that threshold stimulus have to be? Yeah, it has to be what it was before, which is, let's just say it has to go to 50, minus 50 to reach threshold. So it has to be 20 millivolts here. But over here, what does it have to be? 20 millivolts plus whatever this hyperpolarization is. So it requires even a stronger stimulus to reach threshold. All right, so to answer this question is right here. How come action potentials cannot summate? Because of the refractory period, or absolute refractory period. And now you know the molecular reason for that, the absolute refractory period, it is what? That inactivation gate. And then here's something that you know for sure now that you'll never make a mistake on. Action potentials have constant amplitude. All right, so action potentials will have the constant amplitude at one spot in an axon. But if you have an action potential and it moves along an axon, maybe from your spinal cord all the way down to the tip of your toe, that action potential, when it reaches the tip of your toe, is exactly the same as it was in the beginning, right? It doesn't die away. That's marvelous. That really never happens in any kind of regular engineering situation. When you ever put a signal into a wire or air, it decreases as it travels through space or travels through that wire. Not so in the human body because of these action potentials. The action potential is just different. Okay. All right, so here is a slide that shows us that absolute refractory period. All right, the sodium channels are just closed, and I don't know if I really like this diagram. I would maybe start that absolute refractory period right here when the inactivation gate closes. Here's a relative refractory period. I kind of like that on this diagram because it is just shown in that area where there is hyperpolarization. Right? And hyperpolarization, you know, to be what kind of event? Inhibitory, right? So that's what refractory means. Refractory means that you can't excite that cell once again. And relative means that it can be overcome if it is, if you give a strong enough stimulus. Absolute means what? Absolutely. Yeah, no matter what, it can't be overcome. Okay, because of that inactivation gate. All right, and because of this relative refractory period, that explains, right, why frequency coding takes place. So why is that? Well, if we look at an action potential with this threshold stimulus, all right, so if we keep applying the stimulus during this whole period of time, once we start an action potential because of this absolute refractory period, there cannot be another action potential. Right, and if it's a really weak stimulus, if it was just barely threshold, what happens, right, after the action potential goes down to RMP? Gets into this region of hyperpolarization, and if that first stimulus that was just barely threshold, is it just barely threshold over here? No, it's not going to reach threshold, right? So where can an action potential take place? We're going to keep the stimulus on this whole time, but where is the first place where an action potential can happen? Yeah, it's way over here, right, until that relative refractory period went away, and now that old really weak but still stimulus threshold stimulus can cause another action potential way out over here in time, like milliseconds later, right? Now, what will happen if, in this case over here, if the stimulus intensity is really strong, way above threshold, what happens to this action potential? Well, yeah. Absolute refractory period, nothing can happen, but this now stimulus is so strong it can overcome this hyperpolarization, right? And it can still reach threshold way over here compared to way over here. So can you see that this action potential will happen faster the second time? Because that really strong stimulus can overcome this area of hyperpolarization, right? And so that's why strong stimuli increase the frequency of action potentials that are transmitted, but never the amplitude, never the duration, right? A strong stimulus can overcome this relative refractory period. And that's why frequency coding can take place. All right, so this is strange. You're going to have to look at that. I don't even know if it's so strange. I don't even know if you think about it right now, you can come up with a question. But if you can come up with a question, now's a good time to ask me. Anybody have a question about that? I know you might have to look at it, but here's a question.
You're saying that when you have a higher frequency or higher stimuli, that you can go back to depolarization?
Okay. So a stimulus is always going to depolarize.
Yes.
Yeah, by definition. Let's just say that this second one right here is just barely threshold. It just reaches threshold. Okay, and so here is that first action potential. And in this region right here, that barely threshold stimulus can't get back to threshold because we have to add some additional strength to it, right, to overcome this hyperpolarization. So this whole period of time, we have the stimulus applied, but the stimulus can't depolarize the cell enough to get to threshold because of this hyperpolarization. But if we increase the stimulus strength right here during the relative refractory period, since it's way above threshold, it can overcome this, right, this hyperpolarization and still depolarize enough to reach threshold. It can overcome this area, and because it can overcome this relative refractory period, that action potential will happen soon thereafter this first one. But if it was just a threshold stimulus, you would have to wait to way over here in order for it to reach threshold. Okay, so if the stimulus intensity is strong enough, these action potentials can happen at a fast frequency. If it is just barely a threshold stimulus, then the frequency is way decreased because threshold stimulus can't overcome this area of hyperpolarization. And remember, that's inhibition, right? So a threshold stimulus can't overcome this inhibition, right, to produce another action potential until this relative refractory period has gone away completely. And so the action potentials will come at a lower rate as a result.
But
yes.
But the only way to increase the action potential is not just because how strong the stimulus is, but just because the diffusion of the first action potential, they increase to depolarization.
Well, you know what? This first action potential has an effect on the second action potential, but it can only be an inhibitory way, by inhibition. Right, in an absolute inhibitory fashion before RMP, but in a relatively inhibitory way after RMP when we have this hyperpolarization. All right, so that's the only effect. Okay, so that's why things cannot summate. That's why action potentials cannot summate.
But on this picture, if we want to...
This one here?
No.
This one here?
Yeah. For this picture, if we want to, like, increase more action potential,
oh, the frequency? Or we can never increase the amplitude. Never, 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 because that inactivation gate prevents that from happening. We can get an action potential to happen sooner by giving the cell a stimulus that will reach threshold, but what does it have to do? It doesn't start at RMP. It has to start way over here, way below RMP. So it has to be a threshold stimulus plus whatever this is as well. And we can say, we could maybe draw a line, maybe this is 10 millivolts, right? So you'd have to have a stimulus which is additionally 10 millivolts stronger to overcome this hyperpolarization, to get an action potential happening here.
Can an action potential happen as soon as you cross that threshold line, like right there?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's a strange circumstance, but I suppose it's possible.
That's if it's really strong,
yeah. I think the slope is really very, very steep, and it would be really hard. It would be really hard to time it just right. Okay. All right, so all that discussion has to do with frequency coding. All right, so just remember, as the stimulus intensity increases, the frequency of action potentials increases, but not the amplitude, not the duration. All right, so that is the first kind of electrical event that we're looking at on a cell membrane, and that is what, an action potential, right? We're looking at this action potential right here. There are other ways. There are other electrical events that can change the electrical properties of a cell, and those are what we're going to call graded potentials. Right? A different kind of beast, a graded potential. And a graded potential is we're going to stimulate this a cell. So here is a cell, and this is going to be part of an axon. But let's just think that this is an axon that does not have voltage-gated channels. So maybe we could even think of this as a dendrite, for instance. That's probably a better way to think of it. And how would we excite, so maybe cross axon off and put dendrite right here. All right, so how would we excite this dendrite? By injecting some kind of positive charge inside the cell. That could be with an electrical current, that could be with sodium ions or some other kind of positively charged ion. All right, so let's inject some positive charge into this part of the cell, and it's going to cause a current to flow through this particular part of the cell. And if it's a graded potential, all right, then it's not going to activate any voltage-gated channels. That signal is going to die away as you move away from the site of where that stimulus was. Remember, if there are voltage-gated channels, the signal doesn't die away. If there's no voltage-gated channels here, the signal is going to die away. And because the signal changes amplitude as it moves along the cell, we say that is a graded potential. Sometimes it's high, sometimes it's intermediate, sometimes it's really low. That's what we mean by graded. Graded means what? High, low, something in between. So here is a graded potential, and it moves with decrement through a cell because some of that current can leak out through the cell, through the membrane, and there's also resistance, electrical resistance within the cell for those two main reasons. So the signal dies away, and eventually it's going to die away completely. All right, so maybe you could think of this as maybe like the ringing of a bell. When a bell starts to ring, if you don't excite the bell again, what happens to it? It just dies away, right? It just rings to zero. Okay, and this graded potential will propagate better the thicker this particular cell is, or axon. So larger diameter axons or dendrites can transmit graded potentials more easily. So a graded potential is not due to a voltage-gated channel, because voltage-gated channel produces what kind of potential? Action potential. What produces this kind of potential, when you don't have an electrical probe like that, is called a ligand-gated channel. Right. A ligand-gated channel is a channel in a membrane that has to bind something before it opens up or closes. And the something that has to bind to that channel is a lot smaller than the channel itself, and so we call that a ligand. A ligand is just something really small that binds to a membrane protein. Okay, and let's take a look. Let's go to a real axon. All right, so here we have an axon, and in real life, it's going to have voltage-gated channels. All right, and if there is some area of excitation, like for instance sodium entering the cell, that's going to depolarize the membrane over here. When that action potential ensues, then this membrane depolarizes a lot, which then causes this next segment of this axon to depolarize, which we see down over in this next area. Right? And when this area here depolarizes, that causes this next segment of an axon to depolarize. All right, so how do you see this excitation moving? Do you see it moving from left to right? Yeah, I see it moving from left to right. All right, now when this center area becomes depolarized, why can't that depolarization go backwards? Can't go backwards. Why can't it go backwards? Because of refractory period. Right, so once this area here gets excited, depolarizes, it can't depolarize again because that's just the nature of those voltage-gated channels in the membrane. All right, so if you were to draw the motion of an action potential down this axon, right, how would you draw it? What kind of arrow would you use? Would you go from the tip up to the cell body down to the tip, or bidirectional? Body to the tip. And it can't ever go backwards. Why can't an action potential not go backwards? Because of the refractory period, right? So action potentials only go in one direction. And in this particular case, this axon is not myelinated. Right? This is a relatively slow process. This happens at about 2 miles per hour, so it's pretty slow. Do you remember a way that we can speed up the rate of an impulse conduction down an axon? By myelination. Myelin is a lipid. Myelin is a lipid which insulates this axon right here so that electrical charges can't leave the cell. Right? And so that just increases the electrical ability of this axon to conduct electrical impulses. So here we see that the same kind of axon, but now we have myelinated it. And in this region, this is what we call a node of Ranvier. Node of Ranvier's have voltage-gated channels in them. All right, so what can a node of Ranvier produce since it has voltage-gated channels? An action potential. Underneath the myelin sheath, okay, there are no voltage-gated channels. So we don't have action potentials over here. But because that myelin is an insulator, the graded potential that's produced by the action potential can exist for a longer period of time. Even though it's dying away, by the time it gets to the opposite end of this Schwann cell right here, it is still at threshold. So what can it produce at this next node of Ranvier? Another action potential, right, which is exactly the same as the one that was right here. That produces a graded potential underneath this Schwann cell, and it's dying away, but not very fast because the myelin is preventing the leak of current out of the cell. It is still threshold. By the time it reaches this next node, what happens here? Another action potential. Okay, so let's follow that discussion. So what happens at this node? Another action potential. All right, so this action potential, if it is a myelinated axon, skips from node to node to node, okay, as a result. So this myelin just preserves, right, that graded potential so that it doesn't die away until it gets to the next node. And when an action potential can travel down a myelinated axon, look at the speed. As fast as 300 miles an hour compared to, what did we say, 2 over here?
2 miles.
Yeah, 2 miles an hour. All right, so skipping down an axon because it's myelinated is much faster. And the reason why this works is because this myelination prevents the leakage of current out of the cell. And it is still at threshold by the time it reaches the next node of Ranvier. This kind, yes, question.
So it's the same action potential, right, that's going down, or it's the same firing off.
Okay, so here is an action potential.
Yes.
It has a certain amplitude and duration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's just in this area right here. It produces that graded potential underneath this Schwann cell. When it gets to this node between another Schwann cell, it is still at threshold, so that triggers another action potential. All right, so this first action potential is stuck right here. The second action potential is stuck right here. The second action potential has exactly the same amplitude and duration. So, yeah, it's exactly the same as the first, but it's a different action potential. It hasn't traveled down the axon. It has skipped from one node to the next. And then it's going to trigger an action potential over here. So I'm not sure it really is important to think of if it is exactly the same action potential or not. I mean, all action potentials are the same. All right, so you can think of it as this action potential skipping to over here. Right, but it doesn't happen underneath the Schwann cell because there are no voltage-gated channels there. I don't know if I could answer your question or not. Okay. Okay. So just think, just always use that terminology, all action potentials are the same. Okay. And by the time it reaches all the way down at the end of this axon, you know, it could be meters away, that action potential is going to be exactly the same, amplitude and duration. All right, so this kind of conduction of action potentials we call saltatory. Saltatory conduction if it's a myelinated axon. If it's a non-myelinated axon, like we say right here, we say it's continuous conduction. Continuous conduction is slow. Saltatory conduction is fast. Oh, here it says, right here in the slide, saltatory conduction. Saltatory is conduction. Well, what does an axon have to have? It has to be myelinated. That's right. Okay. And the other thing, when we say axon, we're going to think of voltage-gated channels, which is something that's necessary for an action potential to take place. Okay. And I just talked a little bit about graded potentials. Just remember they're different than action potentials because they die away from the site where they were created, right? And also they can summate and they travel with decrement. Because they die away, they travel with decrement. So there's some differences between action potentials and graded potentials. We're going to have to talk about why a graded potential comes to be. And so we're going to talk about communication between cells, and that structural and functional unit of communication between cells is what we call a synapse. Remember, we talked about the structural and functional unit of life. What was that?
Cell.
A cell. That's right. Did we talk about another structural and functional unit of anything yet in here? I think not, but we're going to talk about some. The next one we're going to talk about is the synapse. So if you know how one synapse works, guess what? You're going to know how pretty much all synapses work with some modifications here and there. Okay, so a synapse. Let's take a look at one. Oh, I tell you what. There are actually two kinds of synapses in your body. So maybe put a one and two. Number one, right, is what we call a chemical synapse. And number two is an electrical synapse. And so this is a way for two cells to communicate with each other. So a synapse joins two cells together in a functional way. And it's a way of sharing information. And a chemical synapse, that information is shared as what kind of signal? And a neurotransmitter is a chemical, right? So it's shared as a chemical signal. But in an electrical synapse, that information between cells is shared as an electrical signal, right? So typically what is used for electrical purposes in your body? What can be used as an electrical event? Ions, right? Because ions have an electrical charge. And if you put an ion in motion, then that's an electrical current, right? And not, so I want you to focus on that as an electrical event, not a chemical event. All right, so there are two kinds of synapses, chemical and electrical. And the first one we're going to talk about is an electrical synapse, because it's not very complicated. All right, so what do we see on this slide right here? Okay, I see a gap junction. Gap junctions are placed within?
Two cells
within the plasma membrane. You see this old plasma membrane right here? Indeed you do, right? And what's the component of this plasma membrane?
Phospholipid.
And this inner part of the plasma membrane, what's the nature of this inner part of the plasma membrane? It is not like water. It is? Nonpolar. Water is polar, right? Okay. So here is this inner part of the membrane. It won't allow charged substances or polar substances through, right? And so what ion is usually high on the outside of a cell? Sodium. Can sodium get through this plasma membrane? No, because it's way too polar to do that. Okay. Well, okay, and the same for this other cell down here at the bottom. So I see two cells. Let's excite the top cell. What is one nice way that you know that we can excite this cell? We can put some positive charges in there, causing depolarization, like sodium, right? We can put a bunch of sodium inside this top cell, right? And in the meantime, this bottom cell is still at rest. We haven't done anything. What can you tell me about the sodium concentration in this bottom cell compared to the outside, compared to the top cell? It is low. Will diffusion take place? High to low, okay? Sodium will diffuse into this bottom cell over here because these cells have a special membrane component that we call a gap junction, right? So if we stimulate this top cell by letting sodium rush inside, sodium will rush inside the bottom cell through this gap junction, and when sodium rushes by diffusion into, right, this bottom cell, what kind of event is that? Okay. What do we call that when sodium enters the cell? Excitatory, because it causes depolarization, right? So the top cell was depolarized. We're not going to say exactly why, but right, we just say the top cell depolarized. What happens to the bottom cell? It depolarizes as well, because sodium can move from the top to the bottom through this gap junction. That is what we call an electrical synapse. Right, so if you have a group of cells and they're all connected together with gap junctions, you only have to excite one cell, and what happens to all of them? They all depolarize because of gap junctions, because sodium can travel easily from one cell to another. All you have to do is somehow excite one cell, right? And the good way of doing that for that depolarization is by allowing sodium to enter that cell. All right, so this kind of junction, this kind of synapse, is kind of rare in the body, but there is one place where it is really important, and that's in an organ that we want to have it function together as a unit. If one cell depolarizes, we want the whole organ to become excited and depolarize and do whatever it does. And that organ is the heart in particular, right? Because in order for the heart to pump blood, you can't have one part contracting and then another part. Right, can't have the bottom and then the top, because when the top contracts, it's going to force blood down. It has to contract as a unit. So heart has gap junctions, so that when one cell depolarizes, the whole heart depolarizes and contracts as a unit, relaxes as a unit, contracts as a unit. So it pumps blood. After it's done pumping blood, the whole heart relaxes. So what can happen? It can fill back up with blood, right? And then the whole heart pumps again, so it pumps blood. So heart, cardiac muscle has gap junctions. What about skeletal muscle? Would it be a good idea for skeletal muscle to have gap junctions? No. Why is that? Yeah, that's right. So if I needed to drink because my voice is cracking, I reach out to get this bottle of water, my whole body would contract, right? Skeletal muscle should not have gap junctions. It has chemical synapses instead, right? It doesn't have electrical synapses. It has chemical synapses. So here is a good model of a chemical synapse. It's a way that two cells communicate with each other, right? So a synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. We looked at one kind. Here's the second kind. So what is being transferred between these two cells? It is a chemical, not an electrical current. All right, so here is the end of an axon tip. And I think we named this thing once before. What is this thing called? A synaptic knob. Bhutan terminale. Synaptic button, synaptic bouton, it goes by a whole bunch of different names. Terminal swelling, right? So here is the end of an axon, and it's swollen because it has a lot of mitochondria, not shown on this slide, but it also has a lot of vesicles that contain that chemical for being a chemical synapse. That chemical generally is called a neurotransmitter, because this is a neuron, and it's going to transmit that information right in the form of that chemical. And, yeah, we're going to know a bunch of names of some particular neurotransmitters, but let's look at the anatomy of this synapse. All right, so the space between cells is what we call the synaptic cleft. These cells do not touch each other, unlike that electrical synapse where they're held really close together. The top cell is what we call the presynaptic cell. The presynaptic cell has neurotransmitter in it, and then the cell down below it is what we call the postsynaptic cell. And that's how I really want to talk about these. I don't want to say top and bottom anymore, right? Presynaptic, postsynaptic, and we have the synaptic cleft in between. That's what produces a synapse with maybe some other things that we have to consider. All right, so the presynaptic cell has neurotransmitter in vesicles, and that presynaptic cell is going to release that neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. It's going to diffuse across the cleft and bump into the postsynaptic cell. But in order for the postsynaptic cell to know that the presynaptic is signaling it with neurotransmitter, what does the postsynaptic cell have to have?
Receptors.
It's got to have receptors, right? And what do you know about the shape of that receptor compared to the shape of this neurotransmitter? Yeah, they got to match up somehow, be complementary to each other. That's exactly how it works. Okay, so the way that this particular chemical synapse works, when an action potential comes down, remember it changes the voltage across the membrane pretty drastically. There are other kinds of voltage-gated channels in the terminal button, and these are for calcium. And so action potential comes down, it activates calcium voltage-gated channels so that they open up. And which way is calcium going to go? Because you know, where's calcium at a high concentration normally?
Outside
of the cell. When that calcium channel opens up, calcium rushes inside the cell, right? Because it's attracted, because the inside of the cell is negative as well, right? So calcium enters the cell. Calcium binds to a compound called calmodulin. So, and calmodulin then is going to change the activity of some enzymes inside the cell. These enzymes can't bind calcium directly, so they have to have help from this little compound called calmodulin. Calcium binds to calmodulin. Calmodulin will interact with these enzymes, most likely in an allosteric way, which means what? Yeah, so calmodulin binds to this enzyme in a site other than the active site, changing its activity, right? And in this particular case, it changes this enzyme from an inactive form to an active form, and it is a kinase. So what does, now what happens? This protein kinase runs around inside this Bouton terminale doing what? Phosphorylating other kinds of proteins, right? And what that does is that eventually will cause release of neurotransmitter from the presynaptic cell into the postsynaptic cell. Right, so calcium is important to make sure that the synapse is working, right? We call that synaptic transmission. Right, so you know calcium is important because you need calcium in bones. You also need calcium for neurons to communicate with each other, or actually mostly any kind of chemical synapse. And that is why calcium is at a high concentration outside the cell. You don't want it inside the cell unless there's some special circumstances. So you're going to see that this is a pretty common motif, and we're not going to go into a lot of detail about what these regulatory proteins do, but you should just know that calcium is necessary to get these regulatory proteins working so that neurotransmitter is released into the synaptic cleft. And then you told me that the postsynaptic cell has to have a receptor to that neurotransmitter. Okay. Now, what happens when the neurotransmitter binds to its receptor, that starts another electrical event on the postsynaptic cell. So this is how information is transferred. In the presynaptic neuron, it's an electrical event. Across the synapse, it's a chemical signal. Okay? And then in the postsynaptic cell, that information is reconverted into an electrical event. So it goes electrical, chemical, electrical in a chemical synapse. And the chemical responsible is a neurotransmitter. And probably you should know an example of one. Good one is a acetylcholine. Yeah, it's a very common one around. Okay, and the amount of neurotransmitter that's released into the synaptic cleft, right, will change the frequency of action potentials, or the frequency of action, the frequency of action potentials reaching this axon terminus, right, is directly related to the amount of neurotransmitter that's released. Right, the frequency is directly related to the amount of neurotransmitter released. And what is the frequency of action potentials directly related to? The magnitude of the initial stimulus, right, up there, right? So you can see all these things are nicely directly related to each other. All right, so what do we have? I think I talked about this already. APs travel down the axon to depolarize that Bouton. That opens voltage-gated calcium channels in the Bouton. That calcium triggers exocytosis of whatever in those vesicles, which releases neurotransmitters. The only other thing I think that's important for you to know is that calcium can't bind to proteins that causes the release. It has to bind to something called calmodulin first. So calmodulin has a binding site for calcium. The enzymes don't. It's a little intermediate step. And that's what I said right here. Okay, so we're going to run into some other kind of cousin molecules to calmodulin. All right, so that neurotransmitter, let's see what the next slide is. I got to go back to this one. That neurotransmitter is going to bind to the receptor, right? The neurotransmitter is what we call a ligand. It's going to bind to a ligand-gated channel, right? So when acetylcholine or neurotransmitter binds, let's use acetylcholine, I like that one. When acetylcholine binds to a ligand-gated channel, it's going to cause that channel to open up, and it just so happens that sodium is going to be able to go through that channel. What do we call it when sodium goes through a channel because the neurotransmitter has bound to its receptor? Okay. Voltage gator doesn't need a chemical to change. This is a ligand-gated channel, and it allows sodium to enter the cell. What kind of event is that sodium entering the cell? Depolarization, excitation, right? So that's how that next electrical signal gets started, because sodium enters the cell through that ligand-gated channel, right? And the ligand-gated channel only opens up when it binds neurotransmitter. Where did that neurotransmitter come from? The presynaptic cell, right? And information goes only in one direction across this synapse. Can you see why? Could you think of why information only goes from the pre to the postsynaptic cell? It doesn't go backwards. Okay. I don't see necessarily refractory period right here, but I see some structures. I see some structures. Okay. What's being sent from one cell to another? Neurotransmitter. What cell has neurotransmitter? Only the presynaptic cell. That's one reason why signals can only go in one direction, right? And what senses that neurotransmitter? A receptor. And what cell has a receptor? Only the postsynaptic cell. So that's another reason why information only goes in one direction. Okay? All right. Well, you guys are analyzing this pretty well. All right, let's see. We talked about this. We talked about the importance of that calmodulin. And remember, we talked about enzymes being activated by various substances allosterically, which means at a site other than the active site. It could be orthosterically, means it will actually bind to something in the active site. Calmodulin can act both ways. It all depends. I think most people think that it acts allosterically, but it's a really weird molecule. It actually kind of wraps itself around the enzyme. So it doesn't just bind to one little area, it kind of just wraps itself around the whole enzyme. Okay. Neurotransmitter diffuses across the cleft. Yep. Binds to the receptor protein on the postsynaptic membrane, right? Okay. And that opens a chemically gated channel, or chemically regulated ion channel. We call that a ligand-gated channel. Right? So the neurotransmitter has to bind to that channel. That opens it up. If it is a sodium channel that opens, what does that cause? Depolarization or excitation, right? So if it's a sodium channel, we call that an excitatory postsynaptic potential, right? Postsynaptic because it's on the postsynaptic cell. And it's excitatory because it causes depolarization. Okay. Now, that doesn't always have to be the case. Sometimes a neurotransmitter binds to a ligand-gated channel that causes hyperpolarization. And what kind of signal is that going to be if it hyperpolarizes? Is that excitatory or inhibitory?
Inhibitory.
It goes the other way. That's right. And so we're going to call that an inhibitory postsynaptic potential. And there's different ways to think of hyperpolarizing. Maybe it's going to be a chlorine channel. What's the electrical charge on a chlorine? It's negative. Where is it high? It's high outside the cell. But if a chlorine channel is opened as a result of a ligand binding to that channel, chlorine is going to enter the cell. What happens to the charge inside the cell? Yeah, it's going to change. And which way? It's going to get more negative. And what do you know about a cell becoming more negative? Is it excited or inhibited? Yeah, it's inhibited, right? So that chlorine... Right, so that neurotransmitter binding to that chlorine channel is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So there could be excitatory or inhibitory neurotransmitter depending on what kind of ligand channels it binds to. Okay. All right, and then, so these EPSPs and IPSPs, these are not action potentials, but they're small changes in membrane voltage that we call a graded potential. So EPSPs and IPSPs are graded potentials. And how do EPSPs and IPSPs travel along the cell? Okay. Okay, and my question, you have two choices. Either with decrement or without decrement. With decrement, right? Because without is action potential. All right, so EPSPs and IPSPs die away from that site, wherever that ligand-gated channel is. And there's something else that's different about them. They can summate. Right? They can add together. If there are two closely related EPSPs together, they can join together and get bigger. Right? If there is an EPSP very close to an IPSP and they're exact same magnitude but opposite, guess what will happen? They will cancel out. Right? And so what is pretty amazing right here is, what do we call that when we add things together? I don't know, you can't follow what I'm thinking right here, but so I'm going to probably have to tell you. When we add things together, you probably have to take a calculus class. It's called integration. All right. So what is really marvelous about a neuron is that it can integrate things. It can integrate information that it's receiving from cells all over the place. So even a single neuron is an integration center. You've heard of integration center in terms of the response loop before, right? But every neuron in your body can act as an integration center because it can add EPSPs and IPSPs together, and then it can make a decision on whether or not an action potential is going to take place, because if we add these EPSPs and IPSPs together, an action potential can take place if they add up to what? The threshold voltage. Right, so every neuron acts as an integration center, and it can even make a decision on what to do with that information. That's pretty amazing. Okay. So EPSP, IPSPs are graded potentials. All right, since they're graded potentials, do they have voltage-gated channels? No. Because voltage-gated channels produce action potentials. What kind of gated channels do graded potentials come from? Ligand-gated channels. That's right, a chemical has to bind to a channel, right? So EPSPs, IPSPs due to ligand-gated channels, not voltage, right? We find these kinds of channels on the dendrite and cell body only, not along axons. What kind of channels, what kind of gated channels are on axons? Voltage-gated channels. So axons can produce action potentials. Dendrites and cell bodies can't because they only have ligand-gated channels, right. All right, so graded potentials, like we see right here, IPSPs, EPSPs, are variable in amplitude, right? They propagate with decrement, but here is something handy. They can summate. They can add together to get bigger. They can add together to cancel each other out, right? We call that integration. All right, here's a pretty good question. What part of a neuron is the receiving part, and why? Dendrite. I like that. Dendrite. The hard question is, why is the dendrite the receiving part of a neuron? Because it has receptors. Yeah. And what are those receptors coupled to? They can open and close ion channels, right? So I think what I would like to say is that dendrites are the receiving end of a neuron because they have ligand-gated channels, which is another way of saying receptors, right? A ligand-gated channel has to have a receptor. So, what part of a neuron is the receiving part? Dendrites and cell body, because it has ligand-gated channels. Right? What part of a neuron is the sending part, and why? The axon is the sending part because, what does it have? Voltage-gated channels. Well, this is pretty scary that some of you see this. This is pretty weird for biology, but this is great if you see that, right? That's really nice. Right, the receiving end, the dendrites, ligand-gated channels, it's receiving neurotransmitter, and it can sense it because of those receptors. And then the axon can transmit that as an action potential very rapidly, okay, because it has voltage-gated channels. So what part of a neuron is the sending part, and why? Well, I guess we answered that already. Yeah, axons, because it has voltage-gated channels. And an axon will make up its mind whether to initiate an action potential and send it along if the EPSPs and IPSPs add together at the axon hillock to reach what? threshold. It has to reach threshold. If it doesn't reach threshold, these dendrites and neurons can be loaded with EPSPs and IPSPs, but if they don't reach threshold, what information does that neuron send along the way?
Nothing,
right? It just makes up its mind to send nothing. Unlike a skeletal muscle, right? It just always does what it's told. Let's take a look at this slide. You have something that's similar to this slide in your study guide that was drawn out by a student, so it has a little bit more information in it. So I see a nice neuron, right? And I see some Schwann cells around it. I see the presynaptic and postsynaptic neuron right here. And this presynaptic neuron, it can cause IPSPs or EPSPs on the postsynaptic, depending on what channels open up and whether that's an excitatory or inhibitory neurotransmitter. So dendrites and cell body, we say, is the integration center or the receiving center because it has ligand-gated channels. The axon right here is the sending part, okay, of the neuron because it has voltage-gated channels. Right, and don't forget this one right here can undergo saltatory conduction because it's myelinated. This right here is what we call the axon hillock. You remember that from anatomy? Mm-hmm. Axon hillock. That's the beginning of the axon, but it also has another shape that kind of sticks in my mind. What do you use at home or garage or someplace if you have a big container of something and you want to pour it into a smaller container that has a really small mouth? A funnel, right? That funnel is really big, can grab a bunch of stuff from all over the place, funnel it into an area. Does the axon hillock look like a funnel to you? Yeah, what is it funneling into the axon? It is funneling all of that information from ligand-gated channels, right, that are all over these dendrites. Those things from ligand-gated channels are called graded potentials. Right, graded. So all those graded potentials, maybe it starts over here, moves to the axon hillock, and if that graded potential is at threshold, then at the axon hillock, an action potential can start and move its way all the way down. All right, so how does that graded potential, like an EPSP, how does it move from way out here on the dendrite into this axon hillock? How does it move? It's an electrical event. I think it's on the previous slide. Right? It moves with decrement. Yeah, it starts to fade away. Okay, so that graded potential fades away, but if it's at threshold, it can start an action potential. If there are numerous graded potentials, they will all join up right here at the axon hillock, and they will add together, right? Because graded potentials can summate. That's just the way they are. Action potentials can. All right, so here is what makes the decision for this neuron whether to send that action potential down the line. Definitely print out the hand-drawn slide from one of your previous students that has all that information on there. Okay. All right, synaptic transmission. What ion is necessary for a competent synaptic transmission? Yeah, you need calcium, right? Yeah, you need calcium. All right, so we have action potentials conducted by the axon, opens calcium, voltage-gated channels that causes release of neurotransmitter. Neurotransmitter moves across this space right here. It's unlabeled on the slide. You should probably label that. That was the space between the cells is the synaptic cleft, right? And then that neurotransmitter or ligand binds to a ligand-gated channel, opening it up, allowing ions to move one way or the other. If sodium moves in, that produces what? That produces the polarization. I like that. That's excitatory event. That is what we call an EPSP, excitatory postsynaptic potential. But if chlorine moves in, for instance, that produces an IPSP because that's inhibitory. Or, for instance, if it opens a potassium channel and potassium can leave the cell, what kind of event is that? Mm-hmm. What kind of charge is potassium? Positive. When a positive charge leaves the cell, what happens to the inside of the cell? Becomes more negative. Is that inhibitory or excitatory? Inhibitory. So if a potassium channel opens so potassium can leave the cell, that produces an IPSP. So all these different kinds of schemes are used in your body. All right, and if all these graded potentials, when they get to the axon hillock, if they reach threshold, right, then that can trigger these voltage-gated channels. And that produces an action potential. And how does that move down the axon? without decrement, right? Okay. And an action potential in motion down an axon is what we call a nerve impulse. Nerve impulse is an action potential in motion, moving down an axon. Okay. Here is that neurotransmitter that we were looking at, talked about a little bit, acetylcholine. Probably, how many carbons does this acetyl part of this acetylcholine have? Yeah, it's two. It's just a regular acetyl group that you're familiar with, and here's a little choline molecule jammed together. All right, so ACH is the most commonly used neurotransmitter in the body. It's used in the brain and autonomic nervous system. Next chapter, you're going to love it for what it does. And it's used in all neuromuscular junctions for every skeletal muscle. Right, uses acetylcholine, no exceptions to that. Okay, a little bit of a complication. What does a cell need to have in order to recognize acetylcholine? A receptor, right. And acetylcholine can have different effects in the body. So how is it that one neurotransmitter can have opposite effects in the body? Yeah, that's the whole key right there. Different receptors. So it's important to know what the effects of acetylcholine are. You'll notice it's different in different parts of the body because there are different receptors. And I didn't want to just sting you with that information without asking you that. All right, so it's a little bit more complicated. Here are the two major classes of acetylcholine receptors. They're called nicotinic and muscarinic. These are subtypes of acetylcholine receptors. Any kind of system that uses acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter, including these receptors right here, we say that is a cholinergic system. Right? So these are cholinergic receptors. Nicotinic and muscarinic are cholinergic receptors. Nicotinic respond very nicely to nicotine, right, because nicotine has the proper shape, and there are other kinds that don't respond to nicotine very well, but they do to acetylcholine, but they respond to another chemical that's found in mushrooms called muscarin. Those are called muscarinic receptors. Both of these are cholinergic. Nicotinic are always excitatory. I think I want to say that. I might have to modify that. Nicotinic are always excitatory. Muscarinic could be excitatory or inhibitory. All right, so let's think about that for a second. So he said acetylcholine is used at all neuromuscular junctions, right? And so we're talking about skeletal muscle. What kind of muscle is skeletal muscle? What do you know about skeletal muscle? Striated. I like that, striated. I'm still hunting for some more information. You're exactly right. But what's something else you know? It's voluntary. You tell it to contract, it always contracts, right? You tell your muscle to reach for that bottle of water there, does it ever say, oh, I'm thinking about something else, we'll get to it later. No, it just does it, right? It's not an integration center. It just does what it's told, right? So since it always does what it's told, what kind of receptors do you think it has? Does it have only excitatory, or could it have inhibitory receptors? It always has to have excitatory receptors, right? Because it can't change your commands from your primary motor cortex, right? So what you find in the neuromuscular junction are these nicotinic receptors. They are always excitatory. Skeletal muscles never have ITSPs running around on them. They're always excitatory, and that causes the muscle to contract every single time, unless that muscle is damaged, right? You're not taking care of it. You're dehydrated or something funny is happening. That skeletal muscle is always going to contract. All right, these nicotinic and muscarinic receptors are ligand-gated channels because they bind acetylcholine, right? And then that channel is going to, most of the time, open up. All right, here is an exam figure of a nicotinic channel. It's a cholinergic channel, so nicotinic, ACH, that's sort of like an oxymoron, right? Because nicotinic means acetylcholine. All right. And here is, see the nice plasma membrane right here? Here's the protein, the integral protein. This is the nicotinic channel. I see a molecule acetylcholine binding to it, and guess what's over here? Another one. So this nicotinic channel needs to bind two acetylcholine molecules. That's not particularly pertinent for this class, but it's sort of interesting. When it does, then this channel goes from a closed configuration to an open configuration, and sodium can rush inside the cell. Some potassium can leave, but the predominant effect here is sodium entering. And what does that, what does this nicotinic channel, when it opens up, what does it do to this cell? Yeah. And what do we call that kind of graded potential? That produces an EPSP. That's right. So this nicotinic channel, these nicotinic channels always produce EPSPs, which you should see as a, what, an excitatory event. All right, produces, oh, it says right here, produces EPSPs. All right, so can you see what's going on right here? Sodium can't get through because of that plasma membrane until this channel opens up. So actually, it's a really simple diagram. It's a, it's an exam figure, so look at it pretty carefully. Okay, another class, right? Like the muscarinic are what we call G-protein coupled channels. The G-protein is called a G-protein because it needed, oh, we looked at this before, I think. Yeah, it has to do with a second messenger. G-protein, right, because it needs that guanosine triphosphate to become activated. Is that kind of ringing a bell? All right, and that G-protein has three subunits. Sometimes those three subunits are coupled to a receptor. If it is, then we call that a G-protein coupled receptor with a channel. Right? The receptor is not part of the ion channel. Okay, let's look at this diagram here. This is nice. Here is an example of that G-protein. Right, here's the G-protein. Here's the receptor. Here's the first messenger, namely acetylcholine. When it binds to the receptor, right, it releases the G-protein, and it can float around on the surface of the membrane. It dissociates into the alpha, sometimes into the beta and gamma. This beta and gamma subunit can bump into another protein. Here is a channel, and this is a potassium channel. Sometimes when beta and gamma bump into this potassium channel, it opens it up. What happens then if this potassium channel opens up so potassium can leave the cell? What happens to the inside of the cell? It becomes inhibited because when positive charges leave, the inside becomes more negative. That inhibits the cell. So that would be an example of an inhibitory muscarinic system producing IPSPs. Right? Or maybe this is a potassium channel that is normally open, right? Normally open. The cell's at resting membrane potential, and now it closes the channel. What's going to happen when this potassium channel is closed that's normally open? The positive charge stays inside the cell. It can't leak out, and so that depolarizes the cell. So that produces an EPSP. So it all depends on the nature of this channel. These muscarinic-type receptors can either be excitatory or inhibitory depending on what kind of membrane proteins they are coupled to. So here we see acetylcholine as the first messenger and then these activated G proteins being the second messenger. Where do you always find the first messenger? Outside the cell, right? Second messenger inside the cell. All right, so that's an can you see the difference between a muscarinic and a nicotinic type receptor? Yeah, okay. Okay, so the channel is at a distant location from the receptor. If it's muscarinic, the channel and the receptor are integral to each other, right, if it is a nicotinic channel, a nicotinic cholinergic channel. Okay, all right, so we'll start right here when we get back next time. Sign-in sheet is going around. Got one little last point to talk about for acetylcholine or cholinergic receptors. And I guess I'll leave you with one question. Once you excite a synapse, should that synapse be stuck in that configuration forever? No. Because you would like to use that synapse again. So we got to do something with that acetylcholine signal so it doesn't stay around forever. So think of that receptor as being a light switch. Would it be nice to have a light switch that you can only turn on one time and then the lights are stuck on? No. You'd like to be able to turn the lights off and on. Same thing for a synapse. You need an enzyme to break it down. Exactly right.
I'm Stacy.
Hi.
Hi. How are you? I'm Thank you.